Rolls-Royce Motor Cars reported today it saw record sales last year, with its top line surging 49% from a year ago. The company also released a few details on its first ever all-electric car called Spectre. Let's talk more about this with Rolls-Royce Motor Cars CEO Torsten Müller-Ötvös. Yahoo Finance senior auto correspondent Pras Subramanian is here as well. Good morning to you both. Torsten, I'll start with you. Who is the core customer coming to Rolls-Royce driving these sales?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, good morning to everybody and happy new year. We have quite an eclectic mix of clients worldwide. You can say in general, 80% of our clientele is entrepreneurs running businesses, their own businesses, and 20% of our clients are the world famous celebrities, sort of. So what we observed over the last 10 years is that they are all getting younger and younger and younger. And we have lowered average age of Rolls-Royce motor cars in a substantial way. When I joined 12 years ago, we have been on 56 as an average age, and we are now down to 43. And that's a substantial, let's say, change since then, because you can make up your own math. For everybody who is around 60, you need at least some who is around 20. And I think that is great. We have also seen a dramatic shift from being chauffeured in a Rolls-Royce to I drive myself and I sit behind the wheel. Was it formerly 20% self-drivers, 80% chauffeuring? It is exactly opposite now. It is 80% self-driving, 20% chauffeuring.
Hey, Torsten, Pras here. Thanks for coming on. You know, you guys had your biggest 2021 ever, biggest year ever for the brand. How's 2022 looking? You guys have your order book pretty much set right now. Can you reach those production goals for this year?
I think we are, and me in person, very optimistic about 2023. I think, unfortunately, I must say, we have not seen any constraints when it comes to semiconductors or whatever. So we have seen all semiconductors we needed for production last year due to the fact, I need to mention that and want to mention it, that we are part of the BMW group. And they anyhow played quite a good role in how they handled that semiconductor issue. So for that reason, we always got preferential delivery of semiconductors, and the same will happen again this year. So I'm very optimistic that we're going to build all the cars ordered and which are in the order book so far. So we are more or less, I wouldn't call it sold out, but we are now already reaching into the fourth quarter. If you order a Rolls-Royce today, you take delivery in 1 year from now. That's basically how it goes.
So Torsten, speaking about the future, EV is obviously a big part of that for Rolls-Royce. The Spectre, you guys unveiled that last year. I understand you guys are testing it right now. How is that going? And are you guys still going to meet that 2023 target for that release?
Yeah, I think we are well on track with the testing program. We have started that a couple of weeks ago. Cars are now going out all over the world. The most extensive testing program we have ever conceived for a Rolls-Royce. So for that reason, great to witness that in the world. And I'm very confident that we're going to see a start of production in 2023, and that first deliveries to our clients will happen by the end of 2023. Orders and also interest worldwide is already really on remarkable good levels.
Torsten, it's Julie here. I want to go back to what you were saying about the customer changing, driving their own cars, getting younger. How has that changed the design of the cars, if at all? Are you focusing on making them maybe more exciting to drive, less sort of stable, or what's the thinking behind the design?
Yeah, I think you might have seen that, for instance, with Ghost, the car we brought into the market last year, we have already changed the way how we conceive a Rolls-Royce. This is a more subtle way to drive a Rolls-Royce. It's very much done, particularly in the regular wheelbase version, for the self-driver. On top comes what we have developed with Black Badge, which makes that car a real, very enjoyable, drivable car by yourself. But one thing is clear for us. We would never compromise comfort. Comfort is name of the game for Rolls-Royce motor cars. That world-famous magic carpet ride you are riding on when you sit in a Rolls-Royce would be never compromised for, I call it now, sportiness or whatever you want to call it. I think our clients love us because we are magic carpet ride, and that will not change.
Torsten, I'm a car guy through and through. I've reviewed many of your models through the years. It's been a great experience. What can you tell us about the specs on this new electric car? How fast does it go? What's the horsepower? How long does it take to charge? What can you tell us?
Nothing today, because we just started the testing program, so you won't hear any details from me. We will release that later the year. I please ask you watch this space. We will come back on that, obviously. And I think one thing is for sure, it will be a proper Rolls-Royce. And I think for us in developing that car, it was always, and we've learned that from all our clients worldwide, first comes, it needs to be a true perfect Rolls-Royce. And then number two comes electrification. That's the right sequence and not the other way around. So meaning that we would never compromise the experience, what a Rolls-Royce stands for, just for the pure sake that we have a different drivetrain in the car.
Hey, Torres, I just wanted to double click or check on this last thing you talked about with your clients, talking about how a lot of new clients, younger clientele coming in, they want to drive their own cars. You know, are you seeing that they're also the kinds of clients that want to order more bespoke types of cars? And how, and does that actually make it easier for you from a supply chain and chip point of view?
I think very much you're spot on with that. Particularly the younger ones are all into bespoke. You can say that nearly, I would even say 100% of all cars leaving the line here are bespoke in the meantime. And once you are in that game to order a Rolls-Royce, you want to make sure that this is your own car. Clients are interested to leave their personal signature, their story on our cars, and they want to create together with our designers what I would call a masterpiece of art. And it's their dreams, and we are building their dreams. And I think that is very much what bespoke is all about, and that's why bespoke in conjunction with Rolls-Royce is super attractive.
Hey, Torsten, one last question here. You know, you've said before that Rolls operates in the luxury goods business, not the car business exactly. What are your clientele telling you about, you know, the future, where they see markets right now? Are they kind of concerned about where the global economy is headed?
I mean, global economy is always something we watch closely because we are not immune against any, let's say, recessions worldwide. We have seen that in some years to happen. On the other side, we're also profiting when the economy is doing extremely well. And that relates back to what I said in the beginning, the structure of our clients. That is very much 80% business owners. And for that reason, if their business is good, also their appetite for ordering luxury goods is good. So I think we are here in the same league as all luxury goods manufacturers. When the appetite is around and when the mood is perfect, then people are there to flesh out the money and to spend money for luxury goods. And we see exactly the same happening for Rolls-Royce.
Well, we are looking forward to following your push into electric vehicles. Rolls-Royce Motor Car CEO Torsten Müller-Advos, good to see you and good to see you as well. Yael Finan, Senior Auto Correspondent, Pras Subramanian.
After bouncing back from the lows of the pandemic in 2021, Molson Coors is looking to keep that momentum going in the new year. And to talk more about the outlook for 2022 in the beverage industry, we've got the CEO of Molson Coors joining us this morning, Gavin Hattersley, joining us alongside Yahoo Finance's Brian Sazi. Gavin, it's great to talk to you. I want to get into the product lineup for Molson Coors in just a bit, but give me a sense of where things stand right now. We've had so many conversations with companies who say they saw a big bounce back in 2021, and then things kind of came to a halt when we started to see this variant surge. What have you found, or what have you seen over the last month or so?
Well, thanks for having me on. Appreciate that. Look, as an industry, beer industry, overall alcohol beverage industry, we've learned over the last 18 months or so that when you have a surge in the virus, and governments and local authorities put in place restrictions, it does obviously have an impact that's not positive on the on-premise, in particular bars and restaurants. And with the surge in the Omicron virus in, I think it's kind of started in mid-November and obviously is still ongoing, we've seen an impact in the on-premise. The positive side, though, is that we've also learned that when consumers are feeling comfortable with the environment and the virus isn't as front and center as it is right now, there's a strong propensity to want to get back into bars and restaurants. So, you know, we just need to get through this current phase and consumers will be back.
Gavin, despite everything that's going on with the pandemic, you're seeing strength in two of your largest beer brands. Why do you think that's happening at the same time?
Well, yeah, I'm guessing, Brian, you're talking about Miller Lite and Coors Light, and there's a couple of things going on there. One is the marketing and the brand health of those two brands is as strong as it's been for quite some time. We've got a really consistent campaign behind both of those brands, and it's working. And then the other thing, which we've been fairly consistent about almost since the pandemic began, is consumers are looking for brands that they trust and they're more familiar with. And they have gone back to those brands and they've stuck there, both in the on-premise and the off-premise.
Yeah, Gavin, the other interesting push that I've been watching closely here has been the Topo Chico Hard Seltzer expansion. And it's been exciting to watch. Obviously, at a time that we've heard from some other competitors out there that maybe seltzer has already had its time in the sun. And also, I guess, you know, when we look at kind of the portfolios here, obviously your competitor Constellation Brands has long kind of boasted their positioning with Hispanic consumers. I wonder what kind of strengths you're seeing from the seltzer now, and then also if it is kind of a play on maybe some inroads with those Hispanic consumers.
Well, certainly the seltzer market has slowed down, but that wasn't a surprise to us. We never believed that it was going to continue growing at triple digits. So yes, it has slowed down, but it's still growing quickly relative to other alcohol types. It's still growing. I think when the data comes in for 2021, it'll probably grow in the low teens. The advantage we've got right now is we've got the two fastest growing seltzers of the big companies in the marketplace at the moment. You know, Vizzy and Topo Chico Hard Seltzer combined will probably be in the triple digits growth for 2021. Topo Chico, as you rightly point out, does skew towards the Hispanic consumer. It got off to a really nice start in 2021, and despite the fact that we were only in, I think it was 9 states and 7 big cities beyond that, we got a 3 share, and that's given us the confidence to go national with the brand, which started last week. So we're very excited about the potential of this brand, not only in terms of all the increased distribution we're going to get, but also our ability to tap into a market which has not been a huge consumer of seltzers in the past.
And Gavin, everything that the Rock seems to touch appears to turn to gold. His Terramana tequila brand is absolutely on fire. His Under Armour products seem to sell out as soon as they hit online. Within that Zoa energy drink brand that you helped launch with him, how big is that right now? What are your plans this year for it?
It is one of the fastest growing energy, or if not the fastest growing energy drink out there. And for us, it's been a real success story from 2021, Brian. It beat our expectations. In fact, far exceeded them. And, you know, this is going to be a big year for Zoa in 2022. We've got a lot of increased distribution coming down the line with as the chains reset their shelves. And as you rightly point out, The Rock has got a huge following, and everything he touches has turned to gold. And we're very hopeful that Zoa will be one of those too.
All right, well, that is good to hear. Switching gears a bit to the stock price, I'm surprised just given the growth areas you have seen in the business. The stock really over the past year is flat. And I know you recently posted a blog post saying that this year will be a step change for the company. What's your message to investors and why do you write that?
Well, I'm not going to predict or get into why the stock price does what it does, Brian, and I'll leave that to the experts. From our point of view, we're in the third year of our revitalization plan. Obviously, we got knocked a little bit off at the beginning of the revitalization plan with the pandemic, but we've made tremendous progress against all of the pillars which we put in place, whether that's our core brands of Miller Lite and Coors Lite, whether it's our growth into the above premium space with brands like Madrí in the United Kingdom, whether it's in the seltzer space, as we were talking about a little bit earlier. And certainly from a Beyond Beer point of view, we've really laid a strong foundation on all three of those elements. And, you know, this was going to be the year where all of those things need to come together. And that certainly is our plan for 2022.
Gavin, let's talk about how you are thinking about the return to the office, because your employees did, in fact, go back to the office in the fall. You're now, as I understand it, back to being remote. There's been some complications on the way here. How are you thinking about the adjustments that are necessary once this surge maybe makes it a little easier and more comfortable for employees to come back?
Thanks. Yes, we brought all our employees back. I think it was in the early part of October. We did choose to mandate vaccines, and the vast majority of our corporate employees were very supportive of that mandate. And we came back in early October. The energy, the excitement about being back together again was strong and palpable, and it's obviously very good from a culture point of view. With the surge in Omicron, we thought it would be best if we went back to voluntary in January. The decision, I think, was the absolute right one given the infection rates that exist. And we're looking forward to getting everybody back together again at the end of January. We also have mandated the booster shot for our employees, and again, it's been widely supported by our employee base.
Yeah, and Gavin, too, I mean, when our viewers are listening to this, there's a lot to be excited about when you talk about the growth, triple-digit growth rates, obviously always exciting. But just talk to us about the size of the portfolio. Obviously, if you're talking beer, that's the behemoth that people care about when we talk Molson Coors, even though some of these other endeavors, including the energy drinks and coffee even, might be growing. But last year, you saw the poll from Gallup, 39% of U.S. beer drinkers, or drinkers rather, said beer was their go-to. That was down from 46%. Percent back in 01. So it is kind of slipping to hard liquor and other things. I mean, how can you look at the portfolio and say some of that growth in our high-end stuff is going to be able to offset maybe a slowdown we see in beer?
Well, I mean, our high-end stuff came off a pretty low base. We put in place our revitalization plan in 2019. But certainly we've seen strong growth. I mean, seltzers, we've gone from almost no share to the sort of mid close to high single digit range. We'll get the data out in the next couple of weeks. But this is not a small segment, the seltzer segment. It's almost 10% share of the overall beer market, which is 20 million barrels. And we intend to get a decent share of that. Beyond beer is also a huge untapped space for us. And we certainly started off small because we were practically not in there. But as we talked about a little earlier, ZOA is playing in a huge market. The energy drink space is a huge market, and we think it's got lots of upside potential. But again, that's why it's so important for us to make sure that we have strong and healthy brands in our core beer segment. And we think we've got that with Miller Lite and Coors Light, both here in the United States and up in Canada. Our core brand focus in Europe remains very, very strong. And in the above premium space, we've got the largest craft brand in the country with Blue Moon, and with the return of the on-premise, we're seeing that brand in the publicly available data showing growth. So, it's not either or for us. It's both and. And that's why we're putting a lot of emphasis on our core portfolio.
Molson Coors CEO Gavin Hattersley, good to talk to you on this Monday. And our thanks to Brian Sozzi as well.
As more and more businesses set their eyes on the metaverse, one sports league is looking to help its players build their portfolios in the process. The Drone Racing League is gearing up to launch its first play-to-earn game on Algorand's blockchain that will allow players to earn crypto and NFTs. And here to explain how it all works with us once again is the CEO and founder of the Drone Racing League, Nicholas Horbicheski. Nick, good to be chatting with you again, man. I mean, this is exciting just because, this is obviously one of the cutting edge sports leagues out there now moving into the play to earn space, which I think a lot of people have been watching. Talk to me how it's all going to work and how maybe our viewers can even get in on the action.
Yeah, well, it's great to chat with you again, Zach. We chatted a few months ago when we announced our partnership with Algorand, the blockchain technology company, and said that we would be leveraging blockchain to create new fan experiences. And this is one critical step in that. So we announced recently that we'll be working with Playground Labs, which is a development shop building on the Algorand blockchain to build a play-to-earn experience. And for your audience that isn't as familiar with play-to-earn are games where people can have fun playing the games they love, with the properties they're interested in, earning real economic utility and cryptocurrency in the process.
With this announcement as well, you've moved into the metaverse, something that we've been talking about for several months now. And I wonder how widely used it is. I mean, what are you seeing in this space? You know, how many eyes are on that? Because I think it's tough to gauge. We've heard so many companies talk about the metaverse as if it's already been built out. What do you see there, and what is the potential?
Sure. I mean, look, it's a broad topic when people talk about the metaverse. And for us, it involves things like play-to-earn gaming, NFTs, cryptocurrency, all things that people can engage with. You know, there's a lot of people using this right now. Play-to-earn gaming has really been growing over the last year. But we're excited to take it to a mainstream sport property like ours. And we think we're the perfect property for it. You know, our fan base is young, they're very engaged, they're super interested in blockchain and crypto. And so to create a property for them that lets them play online and also continue to engage with DRL is a great combination.
Yeah, I suppose it also kind of brings down the costs to on-ramp, I guess. You know, I've been waiting to get my hands on one of these drones for a bit just because I haven't pulled the trigger, still got to do a bit more research. But if I don't need to spend the money on a drone and I can still kind of control this thing virtually in a video game, I mean, how does that maybe help the on-ramp for people who had been locked out for maybe experimenting with drones?
Yeah, it's another way to get people involved. You know, we currently have obviously our live racing. We've got some video of it up right now with real drones. We have racing in our DRL simulators. We do digital racing. We have a mobile game, Drone Racing Arcade, where people also compete in drone racing competitions. And this will just be another avenue for fans to get engaged, doing it through play to earn, working with NFTs instead of sort of traditional gaming.
And then, you know, obviously this isn't the first time you guys have kind of dealt into the crypto world, as you have the Algorand piece behind you, as we covered last time. But I mean, I guess what are the expectations here around the upside returns? Might be too early to talk about what people could expect, but, you know, given your track record in kinds of some of these prizes and such, what are you foreseeing when it comes to what people should actually be thinking about and putting their time into this?
Look, I mean, if you look at drones, gaming, and crypto, you're talking about a $2 trillion space. There's a lot of opportunity here. There's a lot of excitement here. I think for us, you know, everything we do that gives fans a chance to engage with our races is a good opportunity for us. And I think in particular, you know, as we talked about with the Algorand partnership, blockchain is this really powerful technology. It's going to allow us to do things we've never done before. We're really moving DRL into the metaverse. Play to Earn's a big step in that, but it's not the only one. You'll see us continue to engage in having different elements, including things like NFTs that span real life events straight through digital experiences. So I think fans are going to get something very novel out of this, and they're excited about it. They're interested in it. So it's a great opportunity for both sides.
I think this is like the fifth time we've had you here on the show too. And now I'm thinking of you more as a crypto guy than just a sports and drone racing league guy. I mean, how long are you in this space personally? What projects are you looking at right now, or maybe holding, that you also, I guess, are excited by here?
Look, I'm really interested in this space. And I think one of the things that's really done it for me is starting to work with Algorand and using blockchain as part of our league. It really is eye-opening how powerful this technology is and its ability to do things that you simply cannot do off the chain. I'm obviously very interested in Algorand. That's a big focus of ours. I think, you know, they talk about being the leader in blockchain technology. And once you work with them, you really see it. You're talking about the fastest, most secure, decentralized network. It's had no downtime till it launched. So things that you may not even think about as you sort of toe into this space as you're thinking about maybe more coins than the technology. But once you get to go the technology behind it, you see something like Algorand, and it's really impressive. And for us, look, DRL started as a technology company. We created the core technology that enabled professional drone racing as we do it. So it's really fun to partner with another company that has that same DNA, that's interested in building really world-class technology to enable novel experiences no one's ever seen before.
We're going to keep us posted on how some of this gets off the ground, no pun intended, as we kind of track how some other people start playing in the play-to-earn space. But Nicholas Horbicheski, Drone Racing League founder and CEO, appreciate the time chatting with us again.
Bitcoin is off to one of the worst starts to a year in some time, with the benchmark crypto off about 8% so far in January. Is there any relief in sight for the bulls, though? Leah Wald is the CEO of Valkyrie, which is a key player in the crypto investing space. Leah, nice to see you this morning. Look, tough month for the Bitcoin bulls. Is there something more at play here underneath the surface besides just fears of higher interest rates impacting some of these riskier assets?
Yes, and thanks for having me. You're right. It definitely has been tough. You know, Bitcoin's down nearly 40% from its all-time high in November. Bitcoin sold off for six straight days going back to last week, moving largely in tandem with equities. You know, and this correlation we think is largely due to institutions and funds that invest in both traditional and digital assets going risk off until this uncertainty plays out. So though the prices did dip between, you know, below 40,000 for the first time since August, they did find support. And we do think that they're gaining footing. So it's now above 41,000, nearly 3% on the day. And it does appear to be consolidating, but, you know, it is still well off from the all-time high set last year. And, you know, for us that have been in Bitcoin for a while, we are used to this. So, you know, we're looking at that technical level.
Hey, Leah, it's Julie here. You're used to this, but not used to a Fed tightening cycle, right? I don't think Bitcoin's been around since we had a really significant tightening cycle here in the United States. So, I mean, how does one even predict what a new asset is going to do in a situation like this where liquidity is coming out of the market?
Yeah, it's unprecedented. I think you're absolutely right. You know, from what we're seeing, traders are definitely concerned a hawkish Fed is going to raise interest rates faster than previously expected. You know, analysts are expecting four rate hikes this year rather than the three that were previously signaled. And rising rates, as you guys know, you know, usually portend a risk-off environment. And that usually sees bonds favored over riskier assets like equities and definitely digital assets. So I think you're absolutely right. This is an unprecedented environment from, you know, the pandemic to what's happening in the Fed, you know, across the board. So I think that it's especially important and prudent to watch those technical levels and also the fundamentals of Bitcoin, which I will note actually have been strong.
Leah, this weakness we're seeing in prices, does this, and really I would say an uncertain outlook, does this hinder or hurt the adoption of Bitcoin amongst institutions this year?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good question. I don't think that it hinders or hurts, actually. And I think that because we have seen such, you know, strong adoption in last year, but also going into the end of the year. And you do see it in a very major way from institutions speaking and working with, you know, fund admins and also just generally from equities, you know, a bright spot that people don't often think about, but Bitcoin mining stocks have been surging over the past year. You know, as an industry, they've generated over $15 billion in revenue and, you know, have largely outperformed broader indexes. Also, you know, kind of fun side note, but they can be used as an ESG-focused, you know, socially conscious portfolio because most miners, especially in the U.S., are actually using renewable energy, such as solar, wind, or hydroelectric power to their rigs. So I think if we think about it, you know, in the various elements in the industry, there's definitely bright lights that can still be found that I think we'll keep seeing adoption in certain ways.
Leah, I want to talk about your ETF for a moment, the futures ETF. It was the second one on the market here in the U.S. It is tracked with Bitcoin, not surprisingly, and has seen a downward trend. And you guys, when you talk about adoption, you have not had the inflows into the fund, perhaps, that you might have hoped. Talk to me about that fund, about the marketing of it at this point, and about what you're hearing from people who are potentially interested.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I would say that I can't specifically speak to the performance of the fund, but what I can say is that response has been positive. You know, we're happy with how the fund is performing because we believe that being smaller than others has enabled us to have that less tracking error. And, you know, that's because we've been able to stay in front month contracts. Futures contracts. So I think that in regards to demand and inflows, we are very interested in what this quarter has to offer. Again, I think that a large, and from what we've been hearing, large money managers, large pools of wealth have been waiting to see how the different futures ETFs have tracked and how they've handled their roles. So I think that this potentially could be the quarter where they're finally feeling more comfortable or not, you know, with how we've performed or others have performed. And they will see that as potentially a portfolio allocation and it hopefully passes their investment committee. But we did expect it to take a little bit longer for large institutions to really start buying these futures ETFs and not to be off the, you know, the very front.
Well, we appreciate you keeping it real for us. I know it's been a tough few weeks in all things crypto. Leah Wald, CEO of Valkyrie We'll talk to you soon.
As investors increasingly consider the prospect of higher interest rates, one of the groups that has been suffering the most has been technology, large cap technology. The NASDAQ 100 hit in particular on days where there seems to be that uptick in concern about higher rates. So what should investors do who hold these large cap tech stocks in particular? Mark Mahaney is with us, Evercore ISI Senior Managing Director and Head of Internet Research. Mark, it's always great to get some time with you, especially at a time like this where people are contemplating what this is going to mean. How are you thinking about your coverage universe in a world of rising rates?
Well, Julie, I think you set it up right. And I think the most direct, useful point is that in an aggressively rising rate environment, which is what we're going to have, and I think you're going to stretch me now, I think this is more than a decade since we've had really rising rates. I mean, that's what's really new. That's the new thing this year for tech investors. In an aggressively rising rate environment, high multiple stocks tend to underperform. Why? Because a lot of their value is typically in the out year. So you raise interest rates. That means you raise your discount rate, which means your future profits are worth less today. So that's why of the stocks I look at, consumer tech, the stocks that have traded off the most, 10% plus year to date, are those that trade at the highest multiples, 10 times sales or greater. So you want to be careful about those. You want to be more selective, and you probably want to find more value in tech stocks. You can find it, but you want to focus more on that.
Mark, what are some of the best positioned stocks in your universe to handle or outperform in a rising rate environment?
So our top three mega cap picks this year are Uber, Amazon, and Facebook. Facebook may be the easiest of those. It trades at 22 times earnings, you know, roughly. And for something that I think can grow earnings 20 to 30%, so it trades in line with our discount to its earnings growth rate. They have a ton of cash on the balance sheet. If you were to strip that out, this thing pretty much trades close to a market multiple. For revenue growth, that's three times greater than the market. Earnings growth, that's at least two times greater. So I think that's a great sort of value growth play in large cap. There's also a lot of controversy around the name, but I think they've got what I call fixes. I think they can address some of the ESG discount that the stock currently holds. And I think they can also come up with a better attribution model than, or one that can match what they, the attribution models that were allowed with some of Apple's policies last year that are no longer allowed this year. But I think there are technical fixes to that. Amazon, really quickly, I think you can buy this at the same multiple that it's been at for years. And yet the stock has underperformed because of the major investment cycle last year. I think you'll come out of the investment cycle this year. Revenue growth will accelerate. Margins will expand. You want to be long a name like that. It's also just a really good asset. And then finally, Uber. Uber's our big recovery play. It's the one that's got the most upside if, when we come out of the COVID crisis.
Mark, just going back on Amazon, I am surprised to see how the stock has underperformed on a relative basis over the past year against many of its larger cap tech peers. Why is this happening? And do you see a point in this year when market sentiment on Amazon will start to change markedly?
Brian, you're asking a good question. The stock has kind of traded sideways if you look at the chart for about 18 months. It had some breakout moves last year. And I think what undermined those breakout moves, what brought the stock back down to trade more in line, flattish, really, was the severity or the size of the investment cycle, which was underappreciated, including by people like me. The company had such nice margins during the first year of the COVID crisis because they had such a surge in demand. So we didn't quite see what was happening to the cost structure underneath. When the sort of super excess demand related to COVID and online retail started to abate last year, you saw how much they were spending. Amazon has increased its distribution capacity, all of its fulfillment centers, et cetera. It's increased that by I think as much in the last 2 years as Walmart has built out in its entire history. Like, there is a massive investment cycle going on at Amazon. What happens when you see that? Margins come down, and that was the surprise. That's what dragged the stock back down from breaking out. I think as you go through this year, you'll start comping against that. This company also faced a lot of inflation and supply chain risks in the back half of last year. I think all of those will be absorbed into the business model or comped against. And that's what allows in the back half of the year revenue growth to accelerate, margins to expand, and the stock to take off.
It's interesting as you talk about the unlocking of that effect at Amazon. But are we going to see also another phase of growth at Amazon, not just from those unlocking, but, you know, is there a new business we're underappreciating, or even an existing business that has another phase of growth that it can enter?
I think so, Julie. I'm not sure. I think so. I refer to the company as hunting three big whales in its retail business. One is that, you know, look, we're going more and more towards one day delivery, guaranteed one day delivery, and then what I call super same day delivery. There are now 15 cities in North America where you can order up to 3 million items and get them within the next five hours at most. So that's something new. We're getting faster and faster delivery, and I think that unlocks more consumer spend. So you'll get more people signing up for Prime and Prime customers spending more with them. That's one whale. Second whale is going after groceries. And third is going after business supplies. I think that's, you know, industrial supplies, business services, business supplies, not services, I mean supplies. And I think those are all three relatively, they're all very sizable whales. And I think they can allow, unlock more revenue growth for Amazon. I think that's underappreciated in the stock.
Hey, Mark, let's talk about one of the other whales, I guess, for lack of a better term, that people are watching closely right now, and that's the potential of the metaverse, right? And to go back to one of your other picks, Facebook, of course, which isn't technically called Facebook at all anymore, has attached itself to that trend. Is that the best way to play it, though, or should people be looking more broadly or elsewhere right now?
Julie, yes, you're right. Thanks for correcting me. I'm going to have to remember it's no longer called
Facebook. Yeah, we're all going to have to remember.
I think this metaverse concept is, it's not just a concept. I mean, the metaverse exists now. A lot of people spend a lot of time on Roblox. That's an example of the metaverse. It's a virtual reality world where you can assume an avatar and experience things in 2D to 3D dimensions. You can experience things in virtual reality. That's what the metaverse is. And this metaverse is going to be dramatically better, more interesting, more intricate, more detailed 5 and 10 years, just like the mobile internet is dramatically better today than it was back in 2007 and 8 and 9. But there was a mobile internet back then. So you have to think about this as a gradual improvement. Sometimes we'll see these dramatic improvements, but there'll be an ongoing improvement in the metaverse and in virtual reality. Anyway, Facebook is a play off that. I think one of the product development catalysts that we like to highlight for this year is the rollout of the Oculus Quest 3. But all of this is going to be relatively small and probably not material to Facebook's P&L, to Meta's P&L for the next 2 or 3 years. So you have to buy the business for the core. You have to buy the stock for the core business and think about Meta, the metaverse, as a kind of long-term option value.
Mark, before we let you go, I know you also cover GoDaddy. Do you view that as a short-term tactical buy under the assumption that Starboard, which is agitating for change over a GoDaddy, something happens there favorably?
We're on the sidelines on GoDaddy. We've had a major management change there about 3 years ago. They brought in the former CTO of Expedia to be their CEO. So they've really tried to tech up, if you will, their management team. I think that was the right thing to do. We've yet to, however, see it kind of show up in the fundamentals. I want to see revenue growth acceleration. For growth investors like me, a company that prints, you know, high single digit, very low double digit growth, call it 8 to 12%. That's in a secular growth industry like web presence. That isn't terribly impressive. Now, the question is whether they can fix that or not. And that's part of the Starboard pitch. There are a couple of other elements that they're working on, too. So I'm kind of in the wait and see camp in that space. I prefer names like Wix. And then if I want to extrapolate even more, I prefer Shopify. So GoDaddy's intriguing. It's a show me story in my book. It's a fixer upper story. But I haven't seen the evidence that the fixes have occurred or have worked yet.
I like that, fixer-upper. Mark, great to see you. Maybe when Facebook changes the ticker and everything, maybe then it'll finally sink in for us that it's changed the name. Mark Mahaney, Evercore ISI, Senior Managing Director and Head of Internet Research. Thanks so much.
It's a new year, but the battle against the pandemic pounds is never ending. Sprinkle in a heavy dose of COVID fatigue, and you get a fertile environment for those companies operating in the health and wellness space. Let's check in with WW International CEO Mindy Grossman. Mindy, always nice to see you. Good morning.
Great.
I think the last time, it's always nice to see you. It's the last time we talked to you, I think we were talking about a little bit of a consumer fatigue on wanting to get healthy. Many folks being okay, perhaps, with a few extra pounds and maybe not fitting into their jeans. Have you seen any change in that sentiment to kick off the year?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We had commissioned a study along with Kantar to get people's perspective on how they were feeling about health, wellness, et cetera. And almost 80%, it was a pretty comprehensive study across many different countries, said that they want to get healthier. They need to prioritize health in their life. But on the same side, they are not going to sacrifice anything to be able to do that, which is why we were excited. And I had spoken last time I was on, we had just launched our newest innovation, 2.5 years in the making, Personal Points, which, you know, we started our significant marketing right after Christmas. And it really is empowering people to still live the life they love, but lose the weight they want. And given what we've all been through, none of us want another sacrifice, but we all know how critical our health is, also given what we've all gone through. So to have something so personalized, so incentivized to have you have the healthy habits, and with the newest science behind it, we're really seeing people get great results from the program. And now we also have a diabetes vertical, which is also very significant.
Mini, there's a lot of competition in this space right now. Look at me, for example. You know, I do meditation classes on my Peloton app. You know, as a company, how could WW cut through that clutter?
Now, I always say there's always competition, but there's a reason that for the 12th consecutive year, we were named number one best diet for weight loss and number one best diet program. And I think a lot of the work that we've done over the last couple of years to build out a complete health and wellness ecosystem within our program. And to your point on meditation, we have integrated Breathe, for example, as our partner. We have Obey Fitness for video fitness, as well as everything that we've built and incorporated around sleep and hydration and recipes and all of the content and coaching that people want. And I think it's really important that the science behind everything we do, no matter what vertical of health and wellness, is really our integrity, our efficacy, and the sustainability of the program, which ultimately is the most important when you marry it to livability.
Mindy, I want to turn a little bit more squarely to the business and also to the stock, which we're showing up on the screen. And of course, we should also mention you're almost done as head of WW International. You are stepping down after this quarter. You know, as you look at the performance of the company and of the stock in particular, what do you think needs to happen in the years to come to kind of convince investors to get back in here?
There's no question that the last 18 months or almost 2 years, you know, have been a challenge for the business because we had to significantly pivot, but we were on a path around, you know, really focused on the investments in technology, the program itself. But the team had to do a tremendous amount of work, particularly during this time, to accelerate all of those efforts. And if you look at the investments we've made in technology, in data, in performance marketing, in everything to accelerate the company forward, that's really what is going to set us up for future success. And that's why we're excited about the innovation, the work that we've done, our, you know, improvements in our retention continue. Our gross margin have now exceeded 60% consistently, and we see further growth there. So that's what's really important. I think it's just, you know, people recognizing the work that needed to be done to set us back on a path for sustainable, profitable growth.
Mindy, I'm curious on what you might be up to next.
Well, as I keep saying, you know, right now I have pretty heads down. We've got a lot happening and there's a lot of work to do. But I'm also excited about the future and we'll certainly talk about that at another time.
Fair enough. All right. Well, don't be a stranger. It's been a pleasure talking with you throughout your WW journey. WW International CEO, Mindy Grossman. Good to see you.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. If you're a user of Venmo or PayPal, you know how digital payments might work. But when it comes to the tax implications there for the people you might be paying, the rules, they are a-changing this year as the IRS looks to get maybe a bit of that. And for more on that, I want to focus in on the changes as part of our Taxes Made Simple series presented by Tax Act here. And joining us to discuss is Caroline Bruckner, American University Kogod School of Business Tax Professor and Kogod Tax Policy Center Managing Director. And Caroline, good to be chatting with you again. Obviously, this doesn't impact anybody, or I should say everyone who uses Venmo or PayPal, but specifically those power users that might be using it to settle business transactions. So what should they know about all this?
Well, first of all, the new rules go into effect for transactions you engage in 2022. So when you go to file your return in April of this year, it's going to be the same rules that were in effect for last year. So you might not get this new 1099-K unless you had $20,000 and 200 transactions. The new lower threshold for $600 of transactions for business transactions kicks in and you're going to need it and you're going to get a 1099 for your 2023 tax return.
I wonder what you think this says about the shift that we've seen in the economy. I mean, this is largely, it is about independent workers, contractors, and, you know, the fact that the IRS is now addressing this, what do you think that says about the shift that's happened?
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. Number one, there has been a huge shift to people doing more independent contract work, and they have adopted these payment platforms for payment. MBO Partners put out a survey late in 2021 that found that there are now 51 million people engaged in independent contract work in 2021. That was an increase of 34% from the prior year. And people are getting paid from using these online payment platforms. It's the most convenient way to pay anybody. And the tax rules have needed to be updated in order to account for those changes, both in how we work and the millions of more people that are doing independent contract work.
Yeah, you know, Caroline, it's interesting because we were just having a discussion about maybe what the government might know if we get some more of these digital payments in the future. And, you know, I tipped my barber, I tipped him on Venmo, and you know, I wonder how they might look at things like that when it's not necessarily clear that it's a transaction, but is, I guess, for business.
So that's a great point. It is the service provider or seller who is responsible for tracking those business transactions. Folks need to keep an eye on what is income and what is taxable income versus what is just paying somebody back because they paid for dinner. That kind of peer-to-peer transaction isn't a taxable transaction and isn't something that needs to be reported to the IRS. But if you are getting paid or tipped for services that you provide, that very well be taxable income to you, and you need to report it to the IRS.
Caroline, I don't know if you have this number, but you know, you mentioned just how many people are actually transacting on Venmo. That shift has been happening. And I wonder from an IRS perspective, what this means from a revenue standpoint.
Well, when this tax change was included in the American Rescue Plan in March of 2021, the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is the congressional committee that's responsible for assessing how much revenue this kind of tax change is going to be in, is going to bring in, found that it would raise about $8.4 billion.
Wow. A lot, that's nothing small there, I guess, in terms of the impact for a lot of people who may have not been thinking about the tax implications here on their individual front, but something that adds up to a big number there. Caroline Bruckner joining us for more on all that. Appreciate it. We'll be watching as that story plays out joining us from American University Kogod School of Business Tax Center there.